This is Don Pardo with the latest news from the NBC Newsroom in New York. Later in this program, the National Broadcasting Company will bring you a special broadcast from Paris. But first, the news from Europe. American tanks and troops battered 5 miles beyond the Elbe River today, while German reports say, we have carved out another bridgehead over the Elbe just 45 miles from Berlin. Unconfirmed reports from Europe say that Germany has been split in half, that General Patton's Third Army tanks have battled their way over the Czechoslovakian border. Last official dispatches placed Third Army troops 7 miles from the border, but a late report from the American broadcasting station in Europe, heard in New York by NBC, says that Germany has been split. Other Third Army troops laid siege to Chemnitz and were 30 miles from Dresden. First Army troops hammered out a 7 mile gain south of Leipzig, while 7th Army troops battered their way into Nuremberg. British troops have launched a big assault on Bremen and are only 40 miles from Hamburg. The German Air Force was declared out of the war for any practical purpose today when American planes destroyed at least 463 enemy aircraft. It was an all-time high record for a single day's bag and gives American planes more than 2,000 German ships destroyed in the past 10 days. General Spatz, commanding officer of our strategic air forces, declared in a special order of the day that the strategic air war has been won. Hereafter, the general said, the entire strength of American air forces will be used to close tactical cooperation with ground troops. In today's paralyzing blow at enemy air power, nearly all planes destroyed were caught on the ground, immobilized by lack of fuel. And here is a bulletin just handed me. London, Allied planes destroyed at least 633 German planes today. Now on with the news. Russian armies are on the move toward Berlin tonight, 23 miles from the German capital, according to the enemy itself. Adolf Hitler issued a special order calling for a stand to the death against the Soviet forces, estimated as high as 2 million men. The German high command said a long-expected offensive broke just before dawn today, with the Russians driving forward along a blazing 120-mile front. Berlin residents heard the deafening gunfire of Russian guns throughout the day. Moscow has given informal confirmation to the beginning of the attack. Although there's no official announcement from the Kremlin, Russian commentators and American correspondents are permitted to say that the offensive is on. German news reports say that the Russians have already linked their bridgeheads over the Oder to the southwest and northwest of Küstrin, and that the Soviets have captured the Silo Heights, 23 miles east of Berlin. Out in the Pacific, American superfortresses have brought the total destruction of Tokyo's war machines a step nearer by blasting the Japanese capital again today. Tokyo's industrial center is now more than half destroyed by American incendiary bombs, and the Japanese cabinet went into an emergency session this afternoon following the raid. Here in the United States, a new president has made his first public address, an address which assures the American people that the war will be fought to a successful conclusion, and that peace will be waged with the same determination. President Truman told the Axis boldly that there will be no terms for them short of unconditional surrender, and vowed to Congress and the American people that he would carry out the war and peace ideals of Franklin Roosevelt in full. Mr. Truman called for complete unity on the part of Americans. Looking toward the post-war world, President Truman declared that the great nations must continue to cooperate in peace as they have in war. Now for a special broadcast, we take you now to NBC in Paris.
This is W.W. Chaplin in Paris. I have just returned from an hour's talk with General Eisenhower at his advanced headquarters. There are a couple of tips he said he would let me pass on to you. I think it's important information because it may save you disappointment and disillusion. General Eisenhower told me that he does not expect there will be any proclamation of peace in Europe until after the total occupation of Germany. The total occupation. And as close as I can figure it from the map, it's pretty difficult because we never know from 1 minute to the next just where most of our front line is. But as close as I can figure it, we have under Allied occupation now, and that includes the Russians. Just about half of Germany, at best. So, if any of us have been harboring great expectations that some very early dawn may usher in the great day, In view of what General Eisenhower told me today, I think we'd better get a new set of expectations. The general pointed out that it would be foolish, to say the least, to jump the gun on a practical day for victory in Europe. We can't issue a declaration of peace and then keep right on fighting for a full half of German territory. What kind of peace would that look like at home? The Supreme Commander told me, as a matter of fact, that he'd rather proclaim peace late, keep America waiting for, say, 6 days after it was absolutely necessary, than go off half-cocked with a premature announcement. I can't tell you where it was I saw General Ike, because it was at his advanced headquarters, and naturally the position of that is secret. But in a certain building of a certain town in some country of Europe, I was ushered up a stone staircase and into a room about the size of your living room, I'd say. But more simply furnished, I imagine. A plain green rug on the floor, a leather divan, and a few overstuffed chairs and some more straight chairs. The only pictures on the walls were those of Mr. Churchill and Mr. Roosevelt. General Eisenhower came in and shook hands with me and a few other radio reporters that he'd agreed to see. He was in battle dress, the snug fit of which shows off his lean, hard stature. No decorations, no service stripes even, just that little ring of 5 small stars on each shoulder that marks him as the head man of this whole business. A big window covers almost one whole wall of this almost monastic headquarters, a window covered with light green curtains. The general sat in a leather swivel chair at a plain wooden desk, with his back to the window, and began to talk. He talks quietly, but with force. I noticed one thing that differentiated him sharply from the blustering general so common in fiction, and actually so rare in real life. In the whole hour we were talking, he never used one word which could possibly offend the most squeamish. At the start, he launched into a discussion of the way he thought, the way he was sure, our armed forces should be set up in the future. He said that it was no longer true to speak of the Air Force as supporting the infantry or armor. Each service has its particular job, he said, and everything depends on coordinated teamwork. We're doing that now at the front. Why, he said, it's got so now that when a pilot gets a day off, he spends it with some frontline infantry battalion, finding out what the problems of the ground forces are, so that he can help more. This teamwork is a fact over here now, due to Eisenhower's genius of getting people to work together. But for the future, he'd go further than we ever have before. He even suggested merging the military academy at West Point, where he went himself, and the naval academy at Annapolis into one great school, with the Air Force's training centers thrown in, to do away with the old rivalry of separate services, to make all members of all armed forces equal members of one great combat team. Asked about Berlin, when we're going to take it, the general just smiled. He said his job was to crush the enemy's armed strength, and he wouldn't be diverted by any geographical plumb. Not even though he knew that that would bring him, he said, throwing his arms 3 feet apart, not if it would bring him headlines that big. And that's how General Eisenhower looks and talks today. I have never seen a man in more perfect health, better balanced or more articulate than the Supreme Commander. He's certainly at least middle-aged, perhaps more than that by GI standards. But our combat GIs are very young. His hair is thin and gray, but I doubt if any GI in the whole armed forces is more fit today than General Eisenhower. You feel his reserves of energy, of strength, in the very quietness of the way that he tilts back in his chair, one leg crossed over the other, smoking a cigarette about every 15 minutes. He's in command of the greatest war in history, and victory is just over the horizon, though he says not as close as some of us have thought. Yet he sat there for an hour today and talked as though no worry was on his mind. In the end, it was we who ended the conference in deference to his many duties. During that hour, the Supreme Commander talked of the war in all its phases, discuss the whys and hows of things that have happened and things that are to come. It all came down to the fact that he is dedicated to seeing the war through as quickly as possible to total occupation and so to victory. And he isn't interested in any grandstand plays like taking Berlin unless that appears to be, at the time, the best thing to do to win the war. In all that hour, he only lost his calm, his almost detached viewpoint, just one time. That was when he was telling about a tour of the advancing front he made last week with General Bradley of the 12th Army Group and General Patton of the 3rd Army. He told of visiting a concentration camp, which our men had overrun, and he said that the things he saw there were awful beyond belief. That camp had been filled with men of several nationalities, whom the Nazis had decided were what they called politically unreliable. So those men were jammed into that camp, and they were tortured and starved until many of them died. When the Germans had to run away, they herded in front of them all the prisoners who still had strength to walk. The rest, they murdered. Incidentally, General Eisenhower went into that terrible place and made careful mental note of the infernal scene. He felt that he himself, as supreme commander, must look at such things, so that if he's asked about them later, he can say, "I know it's true because I saw it." That, I think, is as good an indication of the character of our supreme commander as anything I've found. No task is too hard, too dangerous, too repulsive for him if it's a part of his job to win the war and ensure the peace. The general was asked, of course, during the conversation about the Russian front, when he will link up with them, when we will link up. At Berlin, or to the north or the south, I imagine he knows, but what he knows must of necessity be confidential. A confidence entrusted to him by the Red Army leaders because they do trust him. No one yet, I am sure, was ever mistaken in placing faith in General Eisenhower. Speaking of the Russian front, there's one thing about the Russians that I like. Their lengthy stay along the Oder, east of Berlin, is by no means deliberate waiting for us to save them some of the cost. Like any other army, after a long and lightning advance, the Russians must pause for replacements and replenishments. That is the only kind of a pause that we have made ever since our offensive started, just to let supplies catch up, to draw a breath and go again. And I can tell you direct from General Eisenhower, that's what we're going to do from here on out, until total occupation and total victory. There's just one other thing I'd like to tell you about General Eisenhower and his advanced headquarters. That's the feeling of complete informality and kindliness that pervades the place in reflection of the Supreme Commander's own character. I understand he is a strict disciplinarian when the need arises, but when all goes smooth, it's just one big family. All during our hour's talk, for instance, a little Scotty dog wandered in and out of the headquarters inner sanctum. And when I asked an aide if it was a general's dog, he said, "Oh, no, that pup's just a friend." This is W.W. Chaplin returning you to the NBC Newsroom in New York.
You have just heard a special broadcast from NBC in Paris. Here is a summary of the late news. The final battle for Berlin is on. Russian forces are 23 miles from the city in the east, while Americans have crossed the Elbe at a new point 45 miles from Berlin. 9th Army troops deepened one Elbe bridgehead to 5 miles. 3rd Army troops are across the Czechoslovakian border, according to an unconfirmed report. And that is a summary of the latest news from the NBC newsroom in New York. Don Pardo speaking, and this is the National Broadcasting Company.
Good morning. This is James Stevenson in the NBC newsroom in New York, with the news from around the world and calling in NBC observers overseas. Here is the morning's highlight news. President Harry S. Truman will go before a joint session of Congress at 1 o'clock this afternoon, Eastern wartime, to address the nation and the world, and to assure them that there will be no alteration in American policy for complete military victory and a world organization to guarantee an enduring post-war peace. The president's message will be broadcast over the NBC network. In Europe, Allied armies are smashing toward Berlin from east and west against stiff German resistance. Russian troops are reported within 24 miles east of the capital. American forces are expanding their bridgehead across the Elbe River. And the United States Third Army has driven to within 8 miles of the Czechoslovakian border, almost cutting Germany in two. The Allies have opened an all-out offensive on the Italian front. Every sector is in action, with Bologna the immediate objective. In the Pacific, American B-29s hit Tokyo again this morning. 400 superforts dropped thousands of incendiaries to add fuel to the fires which were still burning from Saturday's large-scale attack. And now, a few words from your announcer.
$1 billion is needlessly being spent each year by the American people in the form of overseeing payments on food. Now, that may sound unbelievable, but it's true. It's been reported that nearly 30% of all food stores are charging more than ceiling prices on some items, and that only a small percent of the housewives are reporting these overcharges. By this neglect, we are contributing to the danger of a serious inflation that would surely be followed by a disastrous depression. It's up to the housewives to check ceiling prices and to question prices that appear to be out of line. If everybody cooperates, this inflationary danger can be stopped. Just remember these six important words. Watch every penny counts. Now here's James Stevenson and your World News Roundup.
President Truman has accepted the responsibilities of his office with a determination and foresight which augur well for the future. His prompt request to Marshal Stalin for the attendance of Russian Foreign Commissar Molotov at the San Francisco conference and Stalin's quick compliance is an auspicious beginning which has enhanced Mr. Truman's position in world affairs. And the entire world awaits today the president's first public pronouncement, which will allay all fears as to America's determined will to bring this war to a final, victorious conclusion and for post-war unified effort of all the United Nations to end all wars. Marshal Stalin's immediate response to President Truman's request seems to indicate that Allied relations in the future will be in complete understanding and cooperation. It is certain that the San Francisco conference will have the stamp of authority of every government represented. And that means it will be able to work with no strings attached in absolute candor and frank discussion so that out of the exchange of opinion and ideas will come a universally approved permanent peace organization. On the home front, some observers believe that there might be drastic changes in the Army High Command arising out of Mr. Truman's investigation of the war effort while he was a member of the Senate. It is thought that these changes will primarily affect the services of supply rather than the armed services. The Truman Committee vigorously criticized several phases of the Army's procurement policies and pointed out waste and inefficiency, which were retarding the quick, easy flow of war materials to the fighting fronts. The committee also criticized several military construction projects, which were never utilized, and it deplored what it called bad management in manpower utilization. Responsibility for all these things rests with the Services of Supply and the Assistant Secretary of War, and it is believed that President Truman will act on the recommendations which were made by Senator Truman and his historic committee. For our first broadcast now, we will go to Europe for a report of late developments. And at this time, we take you to NBC in Paris.
This is Thomas H. Wolfe at Supreme Allied Headquarters in Paris. Most of this morning's war news comes from the two ends of the Western Front. In the north, the Canadians are making steady progress against only moderate resistance. Further east, the British 3rd Infantry Division has reached Brinkham. Brinkham is only 2.5 miles from the outskirts of Bremen. At the other end of the line, the American 7th Army is generally closing in towards Nuremberg. In the center of the Western Front, no fresh news was reported at this morning's military conference. 12th Army Group units are generally closing up on the Elbe River. We still hold one bridgehead across the river. This is being built up. The Elbe is the last barrier before Berlin. And so, the question naturally arises, just how important to the Allies is the capture of Berlin? How does it compare with the strategic importance of a link-up with the Russians? How much strength would we have to expend to capture the German capital? And is it worth diverting that much strength from other possible objectives? First of all, I have talked with no one here who believes the capture of Berlin would mean the end of the war in Europe. Generally speaking, the importance of Berlin to us is the blow it would strike at German morale. As far as Nazis go, most of the important party records and leaders have long since been evacuated from the city. Berlin's second great importance used to be as the center of Germany's communications network. Air bombardments have greatly reduced this importance. Our armies will nullify it completely when they meet the Russians. Well, then, how difficult would it be to capture Berlin? Plenty, judging by recent reconnaissance photos. I have talked with no one here who thinks the capture of Berlin is as vital as a link-up with the Russians. Whether we enter Berlin in the near future probably depends on the answer to one question. Have we sufficient strength to drive simultaneously towards the Russians and into Berlin? I am not going to help the Germans answer this question. And, obviously, I am not trying to hint that we will or will not immediately drive for the capital. Either way, it is important to bear in mind that the capture of Berlin would not be the biggest possible stride towards victory. This is Thomas H. Wolfe in Paris, returning you to the NBC newsroom in New York.
And at this time, we leave the European theater and hurry to the Pacific theater. We take you now to NBC in the Pacific.
This is Robert McCormick at Advanced Fleet Headquarters on Guam. Well, today we had one of the most exciting news conferences in the 15 years I've been in the reporting business. We went over to headquarters of the 21st Bomber Command, and were given a summary of the damage done to Japan by the B-29s in the past 3 weeks. A Colonel James D. Garcia talked to us. He showed us reconnaissance pictures and maps and gave us facts and figures. Colonel Garcia rattled through the information with the speed of a person who knows exactly what he's talking about. He was so matter-of-fact, we didn't realize until later the importance of the things he was telling us. He told us of one Japanese war plant right after another, being either wiped out or heavily damaged by the superforts. He reeled them off, but he was just building up to a climax, and then it came. Almost half of industrial Tokyo has literally gone up in smoke. It is burned right off the face of the earth. The total area of industrial Tokyo of importance to our bomber is about 65 square miles. In two fire raids, the B-29s have burned up 27 and a half square miles. And a third raid was made last night, but we have no information on how much damage it did. Now, it's hard to figure just what all this means, but we should remember that the Japs have a tremendous lot of industry scattered around in tiny home workshops. The Japs themselves figured that they lost 8,000 of these shadow plants in their last big earthquake. And the earthquake wiped out an area almost exactly equal to that wiped out in the 29s in their first raid. So counting both of our big fire raids, we may have burned up at least 18,000 of these little shops. That's a tremendous haul in Jap production, especially when we remember that all of Tokyo is crippled. This is Robert McCormick at Guam, switching you to the NBC newsroom in New York.
A bulletin from the United States First Army Headquarters reports that the German Corps commander in the eastern pocket of the Ruhr Trap surrendered today, and all the remaining troops are being mopped up. Dr. Manfred Zapp, Nazi propaganda chief who was expelled from the United States in 1941, has been captured by United States Third Army troops, and a European broadcast last night declared that Prince August Wilhelm and Field Marshal August von Mackensen also had been taken prisoner. Von Mackensen, who is 96 years old, commanded the Germans' Eastern Front in the First World War. German diplomat Franz von Papen, meanwhile, is reported awaiting processing in Europe as a bona fide prisoner of war. For our next overseas broadcast, we go now to NBC in Rome.
This is Grant Parr speaking from Rome. The Germans can now add Italy to the fronts where they have trouble and plenty of it. The Allied 15th Army Group has begun its spring offensive, and nothing but the most desperate resistance on the part of the Krauts can preserve their present favorable position and keep us out of the Po Plain. 5th Army troops jumped off this morning on a full-scale drive after preliminary operations by the U.S. 10th Mountain Division had secured positions astride a key road. The heaviest air bombardment in the history of the 15th Air Force Sunday afternoon prepared the way for 5th Army's push. 8th Army, well on the way to Bologna after a week of intense fighting, continued to drive east from its positions below the Camacchio Lake. Fifth Army was attacking north through mountainous terrain from position southwest of Boulogne. The Fifth was, in effect, delivering a powerful left hook to follow up the hard right already landed by the Eighth. Polish troops of Eighth Army were last night approaching Castle San Pietro, only 12 miles from Bologna, and on one of the two main highways to this key city on the Po Plain. From Field Marshal Alexander and General Mark Clark, today came orders of the day confirming that the big push was really on. The Germans probably guessed this yesterday when over 1,200 heavy bombers smashed 19 pinpoint defense targets south of Bologna, and 1,600 tactical planes bombed forward Kraut positions, smashed hundreds of houses which the Nazis were using as strong points. At this very moment, the heavies are droning overhead with more presence for the enemy. The weight of bombs dropped by the 15th Liberators and Fortresses exceeded by 400 tons, the maximum previous strike carried out by General Nate Twining's airmen. Final victory is near, declared Field Marshal Alexander. The German forces are now very groggy and only need one mighty punch to knock them out for good. The moment has now come for us to take the field for the last battle which will end the war in Europe. He said the fight would be bitter, but that final victory was sure. Hit them with all you've got, General Mark Clark told his men, and with God's help, we will have a decisive and perhaps a final victory. I return you now to NBC in New York.
And this morning, we heard from NBC observers Thomas H. Wolfe at Allied Supreme Headquarters in Paris, Robert McCormick at Fleet Headquarters on Guam, and Grant Parr at Allied Headquarters in Rome. Now, here's your announcer, and then I'll be back with more news.
Have you written to your loved one in the service recently? Do you write to him often? Well, that's fine. But are you sure that he's getting those letters? Well, if you're one of the millions of people who use V-mail, then you are certain of fast, safe deliveries. Fast because it flies by air. Safe because the original is kept on file in case the microfilm copy gets lost. V-mail is private. The microfilmed letter is no larger than a postage stamp, therefore impossible to read until it's enlarged for delivery. V-mail is inexpensive. It flies overseas for only 3 cents postage. V-mail forms are easily obtainable. They can be purchased at most department and stationery stores or can be gotten free at your local post office. Try V-mail the next time you write to him. He'll appreciate it, and so will you, once you find out how convenient it is. Remember, our boys want news, fresh news, regular news. So write him today and use V-mail. And again, here's James Stevenson in the NBC newsroom.
The German radio said today that Russian forces had launched their long-expected all-out offensive along the Oder River line within 35 miles of Greater Berlin and acknowledged that the Red Army had made one local breach in the Nazi lines. The Germans said the attack, which was launched on a front more than 25 miles long, extended from north of Kistrin to south of Frankfurt on the Oder. Official Soviet dispatches say nothing about any Red Army activity along that line, but there seems good reason to believe that the zero hour is approaching for an offensive on Berlin. Paris reports that French forces are battling to reopen the port of Bordeaux to Atlantic shipping and wipe out 20,000 pocketed Nazi troops. The French scored an initial victory with the capture of Royan at the mouth of the Gironde River. French tanks and infantry charged into the city of 10,000 on the river's north bank in savage fighting yesterday. And that's the morning's news from around the world. This is James Stevenson in the NBC newsroom in New York saying goodbye. And I'll be seeing you tomorrow morning.
This is the National Broadcasting Company. ¶¶